Hello, and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned some wonderful news for those of us who just can't seem to get to the gym anymore. Just imagining yourself working out can actually make you more fit. The nut of this too-good-to-be-true news comes from something called proprioception. Proprioception is something we all have. It's like a sense of the position of your body parts and the strength and the effort that you need to use to move them. So like, if you closed your eyes, you would still know where your right arm was, and you would still know how to move it and what it would do. That is proprioception, and that is also motor imagery. And what's really interesting is that motor imagery uses the same brain activity that is also responsible for actually moving your body. The only difference with the imagery part is that another part of your body blocks the message from reaching your muscles. So there's actually a growing body of research into the powers of proprioception, and it's pretty remarkable. For example, when you imagine exercising, your breath and heart rate actually increase. In another study, an exercise scientist found that imagination could actually increase muscle strength. Now, his results focused on the pinky, which doesn't seem that impressive, but trust me, it is. So in his study, just by imagine exercising, the muscles at the knuckle between the hand and the little finger increased the finger strength by 22%. Now, by comparison, actual pinky exercise increased finger strength by 30%, which is pretty damn close. Now, what these types of studies suggest is that mental practice can complement physical practice, since so many of the same neural and bodily areas are activated during motor imagery and actual movement. So, the big question, do you ever have to exercise again? The answer is yes. Yes, you do. Scientists say mental practice is a supplement to physical exercise, not an alternative. So, if you want to try it out, scientists say 20 minutes is the optimal amount of time to make the mental practice stick. This week I learned that all of our glorious American athletes who medaled in this year's Olympic Games will have to pay a hefty tax on their earnings when they get home. Athletes who bring home a medal are also awarded cold hard cash by the United States Olympic Committee. Gold gets you $25,000, silver gets you $15,000, and bronze gets you 10 grand. And this cash, as well as the medals, are considered income. And as such, the athletes will be taxed by the federal government anywhere between 10% to 39.6%, depending on their household tax bracket. So it totally varies. But let's say you're like Michael Phelps, whose net worth is about $55 million, which puts him at that highest tax rate. That means he'll be taxed nearly 10 grand for each of his 5 gold medals. He'll be taxed nearly $6,000 for his silver medal. And if he had won any bronze, he'd be taxed about $4,000 for that one. Oh, and there's also a tax on the medals themselves, but luckily for the athletes, the medals aren't really worth very much. It totally fluctuates depending on the commodities market, but gold, for example, right now is worth only about $600. All told, when Phelps makes his triumphant return home, he'll be welcomed with a $55,000 tax bill.
I wanted to come back and finish my career how I wanted, and this was the cherry on top of the cake that I wanted.
There has been some action from lawmakers to ease this burden on our Olympic athletes. In 2012, around the London Olympics, Florida Senator Marco Rubio introduced a bill that would give Olympic and Paralympic athletes a pass. While that bill didn't go anywhere, another bipartisan law was passed this year by the Senate and is now kicking around Congress. This week I learned that our brain plays a feel-good trick on us when we've been rejected. A subtle mechanism in our brain alters our sense of belonging. So, first of all, you know how a friendly gesture usually starts with a moment of joint eye contact? It's a thing that makes us feel connected. So if we've been rejected, immediately afterward, scientists say that something called the cone of gaze is widened. And what this basically means is that even if someone isn't looking directly at us, we're more likely to think that they are. Scientists say this could help the ostracized spot opportunities to forge new relationships, just as they're losing out on others. So to find these kind of curious results, researchers had a group of 40 students play an online computer game called Cyberball. Each student thought they were playing against two other players who were located elsewhere, but they were actually playing a pre-programmed game. So half the students were playing a game where they were completely ignored, and the other half were playing a very inclusive game. Directly after the game, the 40 students looked repeatedly at a series of cartoon faces that each had a different direction to their gaze. And what the researchers found was that the ostracized group was more inclined to say that the off-center gazes were looking directly at them. These are uplifting results, and they reveal that our brains are equipped with an instinctive, positive psychological response to being rejected, which helps improve social bonds rather than further a sense of loneliness when we need it most. This week I learned that Americans didn't always pledge of allegiance to the flag with their right hand over their heart. In fact, the original gesture, known as the Bellamy Salute, after the author of the Pledge of Allegiance, looked a lot like the Nazi salute. But let me take you back a bit. To the 1890s, when a magazine mogul from Boston named Daniel S. Ford took it upon himself to design a patriotic program for schools around the country. Part of this meant that the American flag would be present in all schools, and the other part of it was a huge celebration marking the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's arrival to the New World. He actually successfully lobbied Congress for it and convinced President Benjamin Harrison to have a national holiday, which is how we have Columbus Day. To round out this massive commemorative program, Ford wanted a new salute for the American flag that all school kids would say. You see, the late 1800s were still a very sensitive time for the country. We were reeling from the devastating effects of the Civil War, and Ford thought the American flag and a new pledge recited by all school children would be a uniting factor. So Francis J. Bellamy, who was actually a Christian socialist minister, was recruited to join Ford in his patriotic celebration. Ford ordered Bellamy to write the words for the pledge and design a salute. So, Bellamy decreed that all students would face the flag, then raise their right hand, palm down, and point it toward the flag in salute while reciting in unison. The pledge at public events and in schools across the country really took off. And as the country welcomed an influx of immigrants during the 19th century, the pledge became a way to instill patriotic values in its newest residents. And then fascism came along. Hitler reportedly borrowed the Heil Hitler salute from Italian fascists, and soon the one-arm gesture was tainted by totalitarianism. Though the salute had been a symbol of national unity for the United States for 50 years, the country abandoned the gesture during World War II. In 1942, the U.S. Flag Code was enacted and provided instructions for how to properly display and salute the flag. The new salute, which is the same we use today during the Pledge of Allegiance or the National Anthem, is simply put your right hand over your heart. And that does it for this week's episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned here or to check out the week's selection of podcasts, including 7-Minute Explainers and 7-Minute Opinions, go to theweek.com/audio. And if you like what you hear, subscribe, tell your friends, or give us a rating or a review on iTunes. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening. Thank you.
I'm Josh Barrow.
And I'm Lynette Lopez. And this is Hard Pass, the podcast that definitely doesn't want to go to spin class with you.
Every Monday, Josh and Lynette will unpack, examine, and dismiss something you've been trying to ignore.
Aspen's full of rich people who are more or less screaming, "I'm rich, bitch."
All these little nerds on Wall Street want to be just like him.
The airlines are like flywheel. And as the airlines—
I just don't like this.
With each episode, you'll know more than you wanted, and that lunch at your desk will taste just a little bit better.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts or at Hard Pass Podcast on Twitter.